Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. Also, Bristol Community FM, where we hope to be back soon. This week, former mayor candidate Tony Britt tells us all about running for mayor. And Dialect's Chris Searle exposing the scandal. That's investigative journalist Kevin Boylan. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio1word.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Tony Britt. Hi, Tony.
Hello there.
And I know you wanted to start with a prayer. Why is that?
Well, like, if you think about it logically, I'm Little David and George is Goliath. He's a lot bigger than me. He's got a lot more money than I have. And I've got nothing. I'm just sounding out for education in parents who don't see their children anymore. And I would like to change the council tax and call it Good Neighbour and New Neighbour and come up with new schemes with it.
Okay. What's the point of changing the name of the council tax? It's just spin, isn't it? That's the same old stuff from...
Yeah. I understand the spin, but like people like to get a reward for recycling. Why can't we give people a reward? People would like to see an improvement on the payment. Oh, quite a few people moans at me at George's spending a lot of money on these bike cycle tracks, but they're not saying about the people who get it over on their bikes on the payments. You know, noisy neighbours. What do we do about noisy neighbours? If you get raped now, you've got to go to the police station. And they're outside of Bristol. That's not fair.
Trinity Road is not outside of Bristol.
Well, it ain't going to be long before Trinity Road goes. You know that. I know that.
Anyway, give us your prayer then.
Loving Lord, I pray that you give me and George and all the other contendants who runs for the mayor campaign equal opportunities to say their piece. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. I'll say amen to that. Anyway, Tony, what made you run first time for mayor 4 years ago?
When Liberal went back on their word about the education budget, I felt strong.
What was that? Remind us.
Well, Liberal turned around 1 minute before they got in and said, oh, we will not charge for our students to pay for their education. And I feel strongly that my forefathers died for my education, for my health. And when I'm down, they help me up. And so I believe that education should be a free of charge. I think it's wrong that we got now got a charge for our doctors and our nurses. No wonder they're leaving the country. I'm passionate about education. Why can't this country be the centre point of the world for education? And why do we have to charge our own people? When you're educated, you can get along. You can move along. If you pass your forklift test, then you can get a job in a warehouse. If you pass your English test, then you could become a teacher. The same with me. I passed my landscaping jobs test. I passed my driving test. Do you know what I mean? I was allowed to move on. All right, grant you, driving, I had to pay for myself. But landscaping, I never. And many other things I did. I'm qualified... counsellor for the homeless in and for people who comes down to my drop-in. I never paid for that. People paid for me to train for Golden Key and Healthy Living so I can then provide a service for those who need it. I think education should be free.
Well, I think you made your point pretty well, Tony. But so how did you get on? And what was it like running for mayor for the first time?
It was unfair. You think Labour Party, 100,000 advertising, George Gardner, 50,000, Ferguson, 50,000. And then the night before the election, this is what I found so funny, 10,000 Christians was told to vote for George. Now that's totally unfair. Totally unfair.
Who by?
By accounts, 10,000 conservative Christians was told to vote for George. Now, that's not fair.
Who by? Who told them?
I don't know who told them, but I do know it was said.
Well, you need to get your facts straight.
Well, you know, we can all... It's like the lottery, isn't it? Someone told me the lottery's fixed. I don't know the lottery's fixed. I've been doing it every week. You know, the saying, if you don't do it, you don't win. But, you know, I can understand that there might be a couple of plastic balls to, you know, cheat. I don't know. No one's asked the question,
but even
have they?
If it is cheated, yes, well, lots of people ask those questions. But if it is cheating, why are you still playing it?
Because you're always hoping to win. It's like the reason is because I'm hoping that this city will be a pebble in a pond and educate their children instead of letting them leave school with debts.
But the lottery is like a tax on hope, isn't it, for people who are despairing?
So is football. Years ago, before the lottery turned up, everybody did the football. I know I did. You always dreams of tomorrow. Hope. That's what life's all about. Hope.
Anyway, you mentioned the drop-in, didn't you? What do you do as part of this drop-in?
Our drop-in's been going now 5-6 years.
Where is it?
It's underneath St Luke's Church. It starts at 11, finishes at 1.
Where is St Luke's?
Which in Barton Hill.
I would guess there's a few St Luke's in Bristol, I'm sure.
Yeah, there is actually. Anyway, it's in Barton Hill, and it's St Luke's Church, and underneath St Luke's Church there's a crypt. And Sundays and Wednesdays, between 11 and 1, we open up the crypt for people just to say hello. We come in, they come in, play pool, have something to eat. On Sundays is a bacon egg sandwich and read a paper. On Wednesdays is a main meal. And there's always someone there who will listen, or someone there who's been through the same situation as they have. Like, if you split up in a marriage like I have, I ain't seen my daughter for 7 years. And that's why I think that David Cameron ought to enforce his rule by letting both parents see their children or have influence in their children. And the whole idea is because I've been through that pain and someone else comes down and it happens to them. The one thing that people don't want to hear, time's the best healer. But it's true. You know, 7 years and I'm now getting my head round it at maybe one day I'll see Millie Mae when she's a young woman. The system is so cruel against those people who have no money. If you've got a few shillings, you can pay for a solicitor and you can get equal rights to your children. But if you've got no money, then you will never have a say in your children's upbringing, like David Cameron promised.
Now, you didn't win. You didn't win the mayor competition.
But I'm making people aware that we need to educate our children.
What would you really have changed? You're talking about education, but actually less and less the local authority, Bristol City Council, doesn't have so much responsibility for education anymore. It's the merchant venturers and the City Academy, they don't own it, but they have people on the board of the City Academy. They've got the Merchants Academy. They've got Colson Girls School. Various of these academies are run by the merchant venturers. And so the council wouldn't necessarily have much responsibility there. What would you see as a couple of main things that you would change if you had become mayor?
It's a bit ironic that George is a merchant venturer as well.
And well, you know, he's resigned.
So he said, but didn't he say that at the last election, he resigned? Why can't he say live, in Jesus' name, I'm not a merchant venturer? If you're a Christian, that name Jesus got some power. If he says it, then he'll have a guilty conscience. He might even tell the bloody truth. Now, what I would do is, for the education party, is I would go to the teachers and ask them what they need. See, when I left school, there was 10 or more youth projects within our area. I was brought up in Noah West. Now, today in Barton Hill, we got a job to supply 2-3 a week for different ages. That don't seem fair. We're forever criticising our youngsters on the streets, but we don't provide nothing for them. Again, I would approach the schools. I would approach the different cultures and religions. For instance, the Muslims get 10% of their religion. Why can't we tap a few people up and say, we want to keep your children entertained, keep them out of trouble? We can approach the school and maybe we could provide that space at the school after school hours for young people to go to. And so their parents can go work for, let's say, 9 hours without worrying about their children being on the street.
What about some of the big projects that Bristol's talking about, things like the metro bus? Does that ever enter your mind, maybe, to do something about that?
It's all to do with money, like I said last time. Money always shakes the hands of money. When you're a Christian and you say you're a Christian, you stand in front of the audience and say, I am a Christian. When you're an handshaker, one of those secret handshakers, don't matter which one you are, merchant venture, savage, even Freemasons, they all do it in secret, and that's where the money is. It's a bit ironic that our banks has gone bust, but they now own our schools and our hospitals. You know what I mean? My granddad died for health. He died for education, and all that what he died for is gone. is being sold off. George is, you know, in my eyes, someone's got to be in charge. But George is selling Bristol, and he's turning Bristol into another Disney theme park for handshakers. And people can't see it. Look at the bottom of the M32. If you was a pigeon and you fly above, you could see their logo in the route. This has now become a handshaking city, where if you've got money, you're all right, Jack. If you ain't got no money, or look, back in 1980, there was two homeless people. How many is there now? There's thousands.
Well, look, logo in the road. I mean, I know if you look, actually, if you look at Cabot Circus, for example, obviously Cabot, big connections with the Bristol merchants and the merchant venturers as an explorer or a reconnaissance for the genocide of 25 million Native Americans, maybe some would say. But if you look at Cabot Circus, the shopping centre, it's in the shape of a heart. So everyone that goes in there is like a little blood cell going through that heart, pumping around for somebody. But what do you mean about the pigeon flying over and having a look down at
well,
the...
I walk from the Sally Army at the bottom of the M32 there. I can't remember what the name of the road is. And then when you come out to the M32, I then walk towards Brunswick Square. And as you're walking along, you've got a lump of, what is it, marble. And on the left-hand side, you've got marble walls. And then they turn rough. And you look across the road and it's smooth. It's all to do with their setup, with their lodges. They're trying to bring it out in the streets. So when the man comes from a different city, oh, this is a Freemason city. Oh, that's a merchant. Because George wants to change the city centre as well. He wants to take it down by the city, down by the train station. But that, ironically, that's where all the merchant ventures are. Do you know what I mean? Have we got to sell our soul for these people? Do the Bristol Charter stand for anything? You got to remember, when that charter was drafted up, it's because the rich knew if they didn't do nothing, they'd burn the city down to the ground. So who gains out of that? Them or us? It's ironic. Anything to be done in this country, you got to use violence. Look at the riots. The only way those people within that culture got anything is be rioting. Do we all have to go outside and beat one another up to get our justice? Or why can't we just have justice from the front door?
Do you think you're going to stand this time for mayor?
And yes, definitely.
And are you going to win?
Well, that's in God's hands.
How did you get on last time? How many votes?
Do you know what? I was chuffed, well chuffed. As a Nor'wester, and I am dyslexic, and I am disabled. I got cancer, I got dodgy kidneys, and two smashed nerves in my lower back. Do you know, I'm 201, here the book is, and old George is 1-3 on. And Marvin Reed is evens. Do you know what I mean? So the chances of me winning is very, very odd. But then if everybody put a fiver on and bet for me, that would bankrupt the bookies and surprise George.
Well, just a minute, because George is going to love it if lots of people like you stand as outsiders, because it just...
But he's making it awkward.
It takes away the vote from the main opposition, who's the Labour.
Well, let's go back to the last time I registered. When I registered last time, I walked to the council office and it was open arms. They helped me 100%. I couldn't say how good of a crowd they was in the council office. They explained everything and they told me when to appear with me money and what to do. This time, since November, I've been trying to register, and I'm going down hopefully this Friday to register. So that's like, you know, 2-3 months.
How many times have you been to the council to try and get it sorted out then?
Do you know you're not allowed in a council office and they won't tell you where to go? So a friend of mine told me it was down by the train station. Do you know, it took me a month to find out it was down by the train station. The information is not there. And this time I was told to do it online. I'm dyslexic. So, you know what I mean?
So anyway, maybe you can report back and let us know how you get on. Trying to see if you're allowed to stand for mayor. How much money do you need in order to stand for mayor?
Last time I think it was 350 to register. Now it's 500. Last time you had to get 1%. And that's what I was hoping for this time, so I can get me money. But now I've been told it's 5%. And I'm also being told it might be $3,000 to advertise in their book. I don't know for definite. And I don't think they know yet, because I've been told that they don't know how many people are running.
Well, fascinating, Tony, and also interesting to hear your vision for the city, and particularly to do with education and making sure the young people have got something to take into future generations. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony. That was Gert Mint-Fabes.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined now by Kevin Boylan, back again. I like to think of you as our very own Chris Searle. I'm not sure if you like that epithet from That's Life, because so much of what you say, Kevin, on this show is absurd. It's got an element of absurdity to it, and sometimes quite frightening. But also, you think to yourself, how the hell can people get away with doing stuff like this? So anyway, what have you got for us this week?
Well, this week I'm going to continue with talking about the masked men or commandos who operate in the Aegean Sea between Greece and Turkey.
Right, we've been hearing lots and lots of about the migrants, and refugees. Some are migrants, some are economic migrants, some are refugees. And
there's hard to draw a line. You say decide somebody is a migrant and somebody is.
But the main thing, I mean, I've spoken to a guy called Alex Perry, who's Newsweek Europe correspondent in Africa before the Americans closed Newsweek Europe down. And he wrote a book called The Rift, which was really looking at the migrant side of things, where the mafia are very, very much involved in facilitating travel across the Mediterranean and making an absolute fortune out of it. And
well,
I suppose
absolutely,
delivering people into the hands of this Frontex organisation that you're going to be talking about now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the actual traffickers themselves are another subject altogether. So, but what I'm going to be talking about here is the commandos, because in August last year I was on the Greek island of Lesbos, in the Aegean Sea, and I interviewed a Syrian war refugee. Now he told me something that interested me about interceptions of refugee boats, which he claimed were made by what he called German commandos. I asked him what that meant, and basically he said bodies of or groups of masked white men armed with US weapons and who spoke either German or English and who attacked the refugees with violence and terror to drive them back to Turkey.
Now, did he say anything about if they spoke English, what accent they spoke it with?
Well, he wouldn't have been that knowledgeable about it. No. I mean, he was able to speak to me in English, so he knew English.
So, do we know if they were actually Americans or not?
I'm just saying that they had U.S. weapons. I'm not necessarily saying that they're American, or they probably aren't, in fact, or at least not as such. And they may not even be German or English in the sense that they are employed directly by those countries, but more will be revealed as I carry on. Since then, anyway, I've been doing some research on who these men might be, and through a friend I gained access to a refugee Facebook page in Arabic which describes what's going on. This is a Facebook page for and by refugees. It's run by some Syrians who are now in Europe. I've also tested various theories against the relevant evidence that can be found online from the Huffington Post, CBS, Telesur, Vice News, WikiLeaks, Human Rights Watch, Russia Today, Sputnik News, Yahoo News, and other sources. So there's no shortage of it, it's just looking for it. I also been studying an in-depth report on the current state of play with private security companies, this report is called Mercenaries Unleashed, and it was released by War on Want, and in combination, I think, with Campaign Against the Arms Trade. And Pushback, which is made by a German refugee activist organization known as ProAsyl, ProAsyl.
Now, I know that War on Want report was pointing a finger very firmly at Britain as the hub of the mercenary empire.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So this is mostly ex-soldiers, ex-special forces people who are now being employed.
Yes. Though there are people from all over the world. I mean, for instance, it was recently revealed that there's a whole mass of Colombians of all people being employed in in Yemen by Saudi Arabia.
Well, do you know why that is? Because the Colombian right-wing paramilitaries are on a ceasefire. Yes. So they're sitting around twiddling their thumbs thinking, right, well, we've been training how to kill people out in the jungles of Colombia, and we're not allowed to kill them anymore. So let's go and train our guns on some
mayhem somewhere else.
Migrants and refugees.
So Pro Asyl is packed with refugee testimonials, their pushback document, against the abuses they've suffered at the hands of the men, sometimes masked and sometimes not, on both land and sea. Now, I'm going to read some excerpts from the Facebook page. This is a Facebook page in Arabic, written by refugees. And this will give you an idea of some of the stuff which I'm trawling through. This is a quote. The person says, "Some say commandos, some say pirates. I am waiting for someone to say Ninja Turtles to make the story complete. These are from the European Common Forces. They are there to monitor the Greek coasts and stop the immigrant flow. One time I encountered them, they were from Latvia." So there's a bit of information. And then the next excerpt goes, "Can you believe that the same countries," talking about the EU and all the rest of it, "cheering for their slogans of human rights and respecting human values, work on spreading veiled gangs of 3 to 4 men on fast small boats issued by the Greek Intelligence Corporation," I presume they mean the Greek Coast Guard, "with the European intelligence," again, I assume they mean Coast Guard, "in the Mediterranean facing the Greek shores. These criminals attack the death boats before they reach the Greek waters. They cut the rubber boats and sabotage the engines, drain them of fuel, and leave the human beings on it in the risk of death." And then the third and final part, which I'm going to read, is from another person's comments. "Commandos is a word much bigger than what is happening these days. The commandos are forces that belong to a country and are ordered by that country. These commandos raise the flag of any country they belong to or not. They always raise two flags, one Turkish and the other is Greek, to cover their identity. The commandos attack rubber boats to steal people's mobile phones and money and then leave them to sink. You call them commandos, I call them pirates. That is what is happening in the world today, is now the act of pirates." So
do,
those
do they
the
actually
quotes.
Fly the pirate flag? Is it just a sort of metaphorical thing?
Well, from what I've heard from reading various accounts, a lot of the boats, sometimes they have a Greek flag, rare occasion they have a Turkish flag, but usually it's either no flag or it's a mixture of any random flags that they can get their hands on, which could mean anything, of course, which it could be the intention. So I've wondered about the possibility of these commando attackers being mercenaries. The use of subcontraction through PMSC. Now, PMSC means a private military security company, which it's becoming standard global practice nowadays. It used to be very, very small affair, mercenary activity, but now, increasingly in the world, especially since Iraq, it has blossomed.
Well, I wouldn't use that word actually. Blossom, maybe mushroomed, maybe. I can remember after Iraq, a lot of mercenaries were used there in Afghanistan. They were called PMCs, private military companies. Yeah. And you're saying now that really they're taking on a wider, almost like bringing G4S into the fold. You know, private security companies.
Yes, I mean now these ones are now have got the M in it, which means military. So it's private military security company instead of PSC. So this is to distinguish them. The government seem to be using it, especially for controversial security issues, which the governments involved do not want to be too closely associated with for obvious reasons.
Deniability, I think it's called.
I think so, yeah. This is despite the regulations of the International Code for private security companies, which is known as the ICOC, and this was agreed in 2010. It's basically a toothless agreement which was made mostly by security companies with very little input from NGOs, and basically they decided that they would have a code of conduct, but to enforce it was voluntary. So the use of multinational or no flags in the commando attacks may be connected to mercenary groups. And in addition, the War on Want document speaks about, now this is a very interesting find I found in this in their document, was floating armories, which is all the rage with PMSCs nowadays due to a loophole in maritime law. And these are basically small warships, each with an arsenal of military equipment and a team of operatives as is required by the nature of the operation. And at least 20, no less than 20, are known to be currently operating in the Indian Ocean. This figure is given by War on Want. To give some idea as to the number that exists in the world today. Of course, they didn't mention the Mediterranean Sea, that perhaps the figures for that don't exist. These could be the motherships. Now, what's often talked about by the refugees is that there's a bigger ship hanging around in the background and they get attacked by small launches that hive off from the ship. I call it the mothership. The connection one can draw between the motherships and the floating armories, I think, is possibly something to be checked out. The commando-style attacks began around 2012, 2013, and are slowly increasing in number. The evidence I provided thee with the quotes, that was from last year, that's 2015. The evidence is overwhelming in this is a systematic and organized activity that is politically sanctioned, if not also financially backed at a high level. It is certain that elements within the Greek police and Coast Guard are involved. And a number of these, up to 50%, according to Human Rights Watch researcher Eva Kosse, are fascists in Golden Dawn. Yet there are also consistent reports of other elements that either speak to the Greeks they work with in German or English, or in some cases operate independently. These may or may not be connected to Frontex, the European border police agency, which certainly does work with the Greek Coast Guard and police. As we know, there have been recent attempts to militarize Europe's borders, and pronouncements to this end are being made regularly and with increasing frequency by European leaders in the media. NATO too has got involved, and a recent article in The Independent mentioned a NATO naval task force is being sent to the Mediterranean from the Indian Ocean to help intercept refugees. in collaboration with the Greek and Turkish authorities. It is unclear what such a show of force is supposed to do, as the task force includes several destroyers and an aircraft carrier.
Well, hang on a minute, because NATO have got Sixth Fleet, American Sixth Fleet. They've got loads of ships in the Med anyway.
Yeah.
So is this an addition to that?
This is an addition to that. This is specifically to deal with help the Greeks and the Turks.
Not to interdict Russian warships. No, these ones are aimed at the little flotillas. Okay.
Yeah. And Syriza in Greece pledged when they came to power, they pledged the change of their nation's rough treatment of refugees, which was ongoing at the time. This seems to have been arrested as part of the country's bailout package in July 2015. So either the orders to continue the clandestine policy are coming direct from Alex Tsipras' government's offices in flat contradiction to their stated policies, or else the government has lost all control of its border security forces and these are being directly managed by somebody else. I'll finish by saying, which is worse?
Well, which is worse? You tell me.
Well, I leave it as a rhetorical question because I think it's probably the case that as far as hypocrisy is concerned, if it is Alex Tsipras' government that has signed off on this without anybody else, then that's shocking. But what is even worse is if Greece has lost all sovereignty, all control over its over the sovereignty of its own borders.
Yeah, it's also interesting, isn't it, that you've got the political opposition who are fascists, the Golden Dawn, who actually seems running the policy for
it would seem that way.
Also, is there any evidence that the mafia are in touch with these commandos? Because you can see where if the mafia are pushing these boats across the Mediterranean full of refugees, it might be very simple for them to talk to the commandos so the commandos can intercept and rob these people.
Yeah, you would think so. But I've done a bit of research into that as well. And from what I can work out, the two mafias are separate organisms.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, the mafia often talk to each other quietly, don't they? In different
parts of the world. Obviously, but
I've found out, by the way, I don't think
they're a political mafia.
From the Alex Perry, who wrote this book, The Rift, is that there's a vast amount of money that the mafia are taking in Italy itself. I mean, I don't know about Greece, but certainly in Italy, in actually running resettlement camps for refugees. So for every single refugee or migrant that comes across and they put in a camp, the mafia are taking a massive amount of government money for each one of those people that they're looking after there too. So this thing is actually organised crime, really, on a massive scale is involved in all of this and milking it for all it's worth. And of course, they are quite well organised. So one does wonder if this, and maybe we'll just finish with this question to you, Kevin, what you think. Is that this is really a total failure of the EU to deal with organised crime, maybe at the bottom of what's going on?
Well, it may well be the case, but I think it could equally be a policy because we have evidence. Julian Assange, for instance, has done some. He got hold of a document of European defense ministers who met in some location. The British, of course, were the most vocal amongst them. And this was specifically to do with Libya, but it was all to do with blowing up boats and all sorts of stuff to prevent refugees coming over. And WikiLeaks got hold of that and have released it online, but it's quite probable that this was only one document out of many. You know, they could have had several meetings, and they could have been talking about Libya and coast on one of their meetings, and they could have been talking about the Turkish one on another one.
Sounds like a fascinating leak from WikiLeaks. Kevin Boylan, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined on the line now from southern Spain by Kim Ekman. And Kim has written a book called What Can I Do? I think I'm right in saying that this book is really all about, well, we've fed up with hearing all the nonsense on the news every day, the bad news, the government's doing this, the big corporations are doing that, the military are doing something else, and usually either the planet or thousands of people are dying in the process. It can be very depressing. And Kim has done a fantastic job here in saying, well, actually, rather than just moaning about things that are going on, what positive can we actually do to make a better world? Anyway, I'm going to hand over now to Dan Green here at Dialect to have a chat with Kim.
Hi, Kim. So why don't we start by telling us who you are, really?
Well, I'm just a normal working mom, basically. I got into this interest or field, if you like, about 20 years ago or even earlier, because I always felt like when I was at school that this isn't me and the system and the programming and everything. So I couldn't wait to get out of school. So and then I started kind of digging a little bit into this when David Icke's book landed in my lap about 20 years ago now. And I felt so angry, frustrated, lots of tears going on, lots of judgment going on in my head because nobody wanted to know the truth, basically. And today, there's so much easier to access information, but it can be quite daunting as well. So I got the idea to do this book because there's so many amazing researchers out there that's been doing this kind of digging work into these dark fields and but also revealing the truth. Because we all feel that we can't trust politicians, we can't trust the banking system, we can't even trust our food any longer. So, but I'm just normal, you know, I'm not a researcher, I'm not like anybody in this book that I've, that the idea came to me to do. So that's who I am, basically.
Okay, so how did you actually get the book started then?
Well, I thought, how can you know, I got back to myself 20 years ago, and if this kind of book existed then, because we were just getting into the internet then, it wasn't really that you could go, I didn't have a computer in the house 20 years ago, and I thought, how can we get information out there in an easy, accessible way to the mainstream mind, basically, and maybe turn off the TV and maybe start reading a little bit more of what we feel.
Okay, so why don't you tell us a couple of stories from, well, I say stories from the, you know, a couple of the excerpts from the interviews that you've done for the book.
Well, the book is made, it's 14 questions that is asked to these brilliant minds. It's Ken O'Keefe, David Icke, Sam Gardner, Cynthia McKinney, Carrie Cassidy, Sophia Smallstorm, Kevin Barrett, and Ole Damgaard. And there's 14 questions asked, exactly the same questions to all of them. So, and the answers are absolutely amazing. I mean, if you're a newbie in this kind of field, if you want to, if you just feel like, oh, I feel that I want to do something and I want to get information. I mean, starting with these eight people is absolutely amazing. And their websites are in the book as well if you want to dig deeper or if you want to connect, if you connect with some of them. And I don't know, Dan, if you want me to take the questions maybe?
Yeah, if you could give us a few examples of the questions.
Sure. Well, how do you see the world today in the terms of the challenges facing us? Another one I think that we're all kind of brainwashed to get into is, does it matter if we vote or not? Which was really interesting to hear. What are your thoughts about money and the global banks? What do you think about the debt-based economy people are stuck in, and is there a way out? Seeing the madness around me, I feel hopeless. Can you suggest some ways that would help me regain my trust in the future and how to act to make a positive change? And then we go through, like, you know, vaccines, GMOs, chemtrails, what are they? So it's, and, you know, these guys are heavyweight researchers. So for me, I feel really honored to being used as a tool to make this book.
Okay. So what sort of answers were you getting to the questions? So, for example, with the question, should we vote? That's something that I know quite a lot of people want to know the answer to. So what sort of answers did you get to that?
Most of them. I mean, Cynthia McKinney, she's quite political and she's in the States and she's, you know, been involved in politics for her whole life, basically. So for her, it's really important to vote and get engage in that, but also to run for Congress and so on. But the others, the other seven, they kind of answered the same. It doesn't really matter if you vote, you know, because it's not, it's just a show, it's a play, it's a theater play kind of thing. Unless it's in smaller community, you know, on a like in a village or where it's transparency involved and where the ones that are running, for example, are working for the people, not for the corporations.
Okay, so when you've done all this research and asked all these questions, the answer that I sort of would really like to know is, how do we change things?
Oh, then you're asking the complete different, the wrong person, Dan, because it's on so many levels. But I think the people in this book, the eight people, I think they kind of, even though they come from different backgrounds and they've done different work in their life, and they still do, they kind of come to the same conclusion that you need to start with yourself. It's hard to do anything in this world if you're not balanced within yourself. And not many people know who they are these days. They're kind of programmed into, this is what you need to do and this is who you are, and basically then they just go with it. So I think we need to come down from the head and into the heart, and then from there on we can start taking on in this kind of information and start opening up.
Okay,
and so be awake and aware.
Okay, so on a sort of global level then, do you think sort of somewhere to do with this is you know, a big conspiracy of people, you know, some call it the New World Order and whatever, to that are sort of making all this stuff happen?
I don't think it's new at all. I don't think it's a New World Order. This has been going on for many, many, many years. But again, like I said, I'm just a normal mom of three and working, you know, so I don't want to be in this field either. I'm not a warrior like these guys in the book, but I do believe that there's a hidden agenda, and it's really important that people are aware, because if you really ask yourself the question, you know, and start asking who benefits from this, and asking questions around politics and money and GMOs and what are they spraying us with us in the sky and vaccinations and so on. If you start asking questions, you kind of know, you have that gut feeling that it's not right. You know, it's something that we need to attend to. So, yeah, there's lots going on, I do believe.
Okay, so when you look at everything that's going on and the fact that, you know, you said voting and things don't really change that much, do you think sort of it's easy for people to sort of go mad with it? And how would you sort of advise people that, you know, to not go crazy over all of this, you know?
The information, you mean?
Yeah,
when
I mean,
they
once,
start digging into
once you
it.
Start looking at it, there's so much and it's so globalised and there's so much information out there. So how would you, you know, advise people to sort of not go crazy with it all?
Well, I think it's really tricky, because I feel that people, when they start getting into this kind of information and kind of not maybe sitting reading the mainstream newspaper and the mainstream TV channel and so on, it kind of pisses you off to start with. Sorry for the language, but it does. You get frustrated, and then maybe your spouse or your family and friends, they don't want to hear, so they think you're crazy. Then you feel lonely, and please, you are not alone in this world when you start digging into this kind of information. And not even, I don't think you need to, you know, go heavy. You can just take a little bit at a time, because there's always fields that interest you. Does it matter what your kids are being fed at school, or why are a lot of kids dying from vaccinations, or what about the global banks? How are they, you know, you can just tap into your kind of interest and start slowly. So it might be easy to go a bit crazy if you dig into this full time, but which is not recommendable to start with maybe, but also take care of yourself and know that you're not alone. There's people are waking up like popcorns these days.
Okay. And the thing that I've sort of just looking at the people you interviewed through the book, Cynthia McKinney, David Icke, Ken O'Keefe, and Zen Gardner, do you not think that all these people seem to have, and although they're from very different backgrounds, very similar opinions on the matters?
Not necessarily, no. I think they... they're grounded in their belief and themselves. They're very grounded into their heart, and I think they couldn't do this kind of work full time as they do if they weren't. But they answer quite differently on some of the questions, actually. So that was interesting.
Okay, so would you give us some examples of some of the different answers to the questions that we had, or from one of the questions?
Well, voting, I already said. Yeah. Let's see. Well, I was asking if they had a practice that keeps their spirits high, for example, because I love that question, because I think it's really important, because without my practice, I would be a little bit out of balance. So that was a fun question for me to ask personally. And they some have a spiritual practice, very like Kevin Barrett. He's a practitioner Muslim, so he prays five times a day. Carrie Cassidy and Ola Damagar, they meditate. Cynthia McKenna, she hasn't got a spiritual practice at all, but when I asked her, she said, yeah, maybe I should actually. So that question was quite different.
Okay. Well, thanks, Kim, for joining us today. That was Kim Ekman in Costa del Sol, was it?
Yeah, I'm in Spain, yeah.
And thank you for joining us today on Dialect.
Thank you.
Before you disappear, Kim,
yeah,
can you just ask me the questions? Ask me the questions one by one. I'll try and give you just one or two word answer for our podcast.
Yeah, for sure. Do you mind if you tell that they can get the book as well?
Well, of course, yeah. We'll just do that when we finished, you and I. We'll do a little thing about how to get the book. How's
okay,
that?
Brilliant. So, Tony, when did you start exploring your field? Was there a specific event that led you to this path of waking up?
Well, yes, I was working for the BBC as a radio journalist. I said two words. No, this isn't going to be two words. But I discovered that there was very good evidence of child sexual abuse going on in Wiltshire, in Salisbury, particularly in two children's homes. And when I tried to get this as a journalist out to the public, I found actually that both the BBC and the police really were colluding to cover it up. And at which point you realise, well, you know, you can either just say, oh, well, shrug your shoulders. And I decided not to really, and just to really get into uncovering these things rather than allowing a big organisation like the BBC to cover them up. That was definitely my starting point.
Hmm. How do you see the world today in the terms of the challenges facing us?
I think it's interesting that we've got a kind of soft fascist system in the West, particularly with the United States and the United States of Europe developing that sort of system within a nuclear world, you know, nuclear armed world. And I think it's the first time we've ever had the possibility of humanity being destroyed by a conflict between ordinary people and power maniacs, basically, who have spent thousands of years trying to perfect the art of keeping us all under control. So we're in a possibly kind of terminal phase of humanity, and it's not easy to keep your head in such a circumstance.
Does it matter if we vote or not?
I think it makes a big difference to vote, to use your vote. A lot of people have fought very hard to get that vote. And although it might not often make a lot of difference, it makes a small difference. And particularly in local politics, local elections, it's important to try and make sure that you use a little bit. And don't think it's going to change everything, but use it. Make sure you use it. Because if you don't, you can be sure the rich and powerful will get in.
What are your thoughts about money and the global banks?
Well, money is basically a giant confidence trick. And the banksters were the people that funded Hitler in the Second World War, made sure he was looked after, and all the big industries that built up the Nazi war machine based around the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, which is a global banking regulator. So the banksters, as I call them, are right at the heart of the evil in this world, and the greed that attracts them to being bankers, to be able to create money out of nowhere, is, I think, absolutely key to the solutions that humanity is going to come to, you know, to basically overturn this tyranny.
What are your thoughts about, what do you think about the debt-based economy people are stuck in, and is there a way out?
Yeah, I mean, you just need to have money based on some sort of real value of some kind, and controlled honestly and democratically rather than monopolised as it is at the moment through things like the IMF, which are just simply using money as a weapon of war, whereas the Nazis used their panzers. The banks are now taking over without a shot being fired, but they're doing exactly the same job in taking over and monopolizing whole countries now.
We have started to read and hear about microchipping people. What does that mean?
Well, they're microchipping dogs, but you're right, they are planning to microchip people through the use of things like contactless payment, digital microchips. The use of RFID chips is very militarized. NATO use these to identify their weapons as they move around the world. And say, for example, if I was to steal a NATO missile, they would be able to track me where I was taking it quietly. So these RFID chips that are used in our contactless payment cards and bank cards, what they're effectively planning to do is to insert these into people so that you need this to buy and sell. Well, that is obviously totally evil, because it means that the first of all, you haven't got any actual real money, just a microchip, nothing of real value, and they are doing the accounts just as the old Egyptian the Egyptians used to do many years ago. You didn't actually get anything of value yourself. You were just told, well, you've got this much in the bank. But yeah, this is definitely an agenda, and there's a very good website about it all called chipmenot.com, which Catherine Albrecht has set up in the US, which is explains why it's so important that we're aware that this is what they're planning to do to us. I mean, the banksters effectively have bought our political system and most of our press in order to try and get this through.
What are your thoughts about depopulation?
Well, there's a lot of people, particularly in the West, becoming surplus to requirements. We're moving towards a sort of animal farm Orwellian situation where those people who are surplus to requirements, that aren't needed to produce stuff anymore, are being slowly but surely enslaved. You know, that is either told that you're going to have no money, no food, nowhere to live, or else you're going to have to come and work in some sort of mindless office job. Really, it's a way of just, you know, extracting freedom from people so that they become automata, and that the propaganda system is there to try and make them feel like they're happy in that system. Well, propaganda goes hand in hand with it, so yeah, that's effectively, I think, where we're heading.
What is your opinion on vaccines, and is vaccination part of the depopulation question?
Well, possibly, because vaccines, a lot of big pharmaceutical companies make a fantastic amount of money out of vaccines. And so what's happening is that the governments and the health services around Europe, particularly, I mean, I don't know much about other parts of the world, are starting to have big scare stories to do with, you've got to have your kids vaccinated for this, that and everything else. Whereas actually what they really need is a boost to their immune system so that they can build up their own natural immunity to these things. So this is just a scam basically run by the pharmaceutical industry, which the media just parrots.
What are GMOs?
GMOs? What are
yep.
they?
Yep.
They're, well, genetically modified organisms. Well, this is a way of getting into the building blocks of life. And this rather does show you where these people are coming from, the owners of these big patents, these big corporations and the banksters, is that they really want to control life, take over life. And they see themselves as gods because they have almost complete immunity to all these sorts of prosecution for tinkering with basic living organisms. And the problem, of course, is you get Terminator technology coming out of this, which means that their tinkering with genetic material can actually render entire species unviable by polluting that species' gene pool. But this is not taken seriously because there's money to be made. That is the crazy world we're in now, where the legal system is just totally ineffective in controlling what could wipe out entire species.
Do chemtrails exist? And if so, how would you describe them?
Well, they certainly exist, but they are not anything special particularly. They're ice crystals, and they've been there ever since the turbo prop aircraft and jet aircraft have been around, and it's just a byproduct of the process that goes on inside a jet engine. Is you get water comes out the back end of it, and at certain conditions of temperature, pressure, humidity, pressure, all that sort of thing, they form little tiny ice crystals which slowly disperse most of the time. Other times those ice crystals can seed clouds, and so they get bigger and bigger. But I certainly don't believe there's any kind of real chemtrail program. I think this is just a disinformation that's aimed at scaring us. And that the fact of the matter is they love doing this sort of thing, I think, because we can't go up there and check anything. Because it's, 40,000 feet above our heads. We can't check anything. It's just ice crystals.
Please share your thoughts about the environment and the current weather conditions.
This is on climate change. Yes, there certainly is climate change going on, melting of the ice caps. And I think the answer to it is very, very simple. We just stop using fossil fuels in the motor car. The motor car has been used by the Nazis, by the Americans building their freeways, and by the British in the 1960s closing down their railways and building motorways to get everyone addicted to using petrol, oil and cars. It's just the oil industry trying to get us hooked on their products, which they've successfully done. So if we can get ourselves unhooked from it, I'm sure that the climate will sort itself out.
Do you have a practice that keeps your spirit high?
Yes, I do. I'm a Quaker, and I like to go to my Quaker meetings on a Sunday sometimes to recharge my spiritual batteries. I think it's a very important thing to do.
Seeing the madness around me, I feel hopeless. Can you suggest some ways that would help me regain my trust in the future and how to act to make a positive change?
Well, I think you just got to make fun of these things, because some of them are just so absurd. You have to laugh. And I suppose a bit of satire, really, to take the mickey out of these politicians that expect us to believe the rubbish they tell us.
And now the last question. If you could plant one seed in the mainstream mind, what would that be?
Well, I think it's a simple one, really, of homes for everybody. Because I think if everybody has got somewhere to live and somewhere to work, and they're not under the threat of eviction from where they live, then suddenly we start to get real freedom spreading across the world. And I think that's the main thing I'd like to see instituted, is guaranteed housing for all, and to make evicting someone from their home a criminal offence. Anyone that wants to try and do it should go behind bars. I think that would make a big difference.
Great, Tony. You can be in the next volume too.
Anyway, Kim Ekman, would you like to just tell us how we get hold of your book?
It's called So What Can I Do? And it's available on Amazon. It's the easiest way. If you would like it in ebook format, it's available on lightonconspiracies.com. And it's coming out as Kindle as well on Amazon in the next couple of days. It should do.
And in a nutshell, why should we buy it?
Because it's amazing information there. If you turn off the TV and maybe not, it's an life-changing book, I would say. if you never ever read anything else than mainstream news, but also if you're in this field or if you have been reading stuff like this for years, it's still amazing to hear what these eight brilliant minds are saying about, you know, about the world today, basically. And I would love as well if your listeners could mail me, because I'm doing volume two of this book. And if there's any questions that, you know, suggestions of questions for volume two, or maybe people to interview, I would love to hear from them. And they could reach me at info@awakeandunite.com.
Can you just say that email address again?
info@awakeandunite.com. We're building a website around that, but at the moment it's under construction. But the email is working.
Is it possible to communicate with you if people don't have the internet?
Who don't have the internet?
Yes, there are some. Some of our listeners, Tony.
I know. Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, through my mobile or?
Yeah, if you don't mind giving us the number.
Yeah, absolutely. 0034 for Spain, 633-288-556.
Okay, Kim Eklund, thanks very much for indulging me with my answers to your fantastic questions. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guest, Tony Britt, Mayor of Bristol candidate. He's from Barton Hill, Noel West, I think the only one. And also the Frontex Commandos, the mercenaries in the Mediterranean, the pirates. That was Kevin Boylan. And we spoke to Kim Ekman about her book, What Can I Do? She was interviewed by Daniel Green. Thanks to studio engineer also, Rick Margetts. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. Contact us through People's Republic of Stokes Croft. We're just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897. Visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. So that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.